Now, as the FM modulated transmitter moves higher and lower in frequency, it's doing the equivalent of what you did with that frequency dial. When you turned the dial up or down, you saw the signal strength meter going up and down. Now you leave the dial alone, you don't move the receiver, but now the transmitter moves up and down. It's a relative characteristic between the two. It's called slope detection. And therefore you get an amplitude modulated signal out when you do that. And let me give you one other piece of information on this one. When you study truly narrowband FM, and the FM that you and I are using right now is medium band FM, it doesn't work so well. If a person spoke softly into the mic, he would be transmitting narrowband FM, let's say plus or minus 2 kilohertz, so to speak, as opposed to right now you and I are probably using plus or minus 6 kilohertz of FM modulation. But on truly narrowband FM modulation, when you study what the Fourier series looks like, in other words, the method that you modulate the transmitter creates a bunch of individual frequency components that you can see on a spectrum analyzer. There'll be a carrier component, and if I'm whistling into the microphone at a 1 kilohertz rate, there'll be a plus 1 kilohertz and a minus 1 kilohertz sideband, a plus 2 kilohertz and a minus 2 kilohertz sideband, and so on. Once you know the nature and the deviation and the rate of the FM, there's some mathematics you can go to, and there's websites that'll tell you exactly what frequency components are present. The magic of truly narrowband FM is that a single sideband receiver will listen to the upper sidebands only, reconstruct them back into audio, and it'll be rather clean sounding audio if and only if the transmitter is narrowband FM. As the transmitter starts going into medium band FM and wideband FM, then single sideband reception starts becoming very distorted for some very complicated reasons. I won't go there right now. But if you've got a wide enough AM receiver and you're using slope detection, you would get beautiful audio out of a medium band or maybe even a wideband FM signal. But there's a catch. One last thing I'm going to tell you. And that is, as long as the signal you're listening to is reasonably strong, reasonably far above threshold, using slope detecting, tuning the AM receiver off to one side to get the audio, works rather well. That's the good news. The bad news is that if you were comparing how weak the signal could be on a slope detection AM receiver technique, as opposed to using a real narrowband FM receiver with a real frequency discriminator or Foster-Seeley circuit built into the IF strip and a real limiter in front of it, you compare a real FM receiver to the slope detection, and you find out the slope detection technique is, I'm not sure of the exact number, but I'm going to make a guess. It is 8 decibels less sensitive. The signal's got to be at least 8 dB stronger before you get good audio out of it and you can recognize what the guy is saying. In the case of single sideband FM, for a truly narrowband FM signal, the possibility exists that the sideband receiver will have greater sensitivity than a properly designed FM radio. Ain't that crazy? Back to you, Steve. Correction, Bernie. K2 Mike Uniform. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, K2MU, I hope you're copying me okay. I'll make the transition short. I am mobile with the HD in the car, but I'm not far from the repeater. Now, the follow-up question, the part that I don't get is FM being frequency modulation and AM being amplitude modulation. Is there a change in the amplitude of an FM signal? Is that why that's working?
A very good guess. And the answer is no. If you made by the way, you're good copy right now. You made a very good common sense guess, and the answer is no. In the case of an FM modulated signal, if it's working correctly, if that transmitter is working correctly, during the time you're transmitting, if you're set for, let me pick a number, 30 watts of output, at every instant of time, during the modulation, you're transmitting exactly 30 watts of total signal going to the antenna. The FM modulated transmitter simply makes the frequency go higher during the time the voltage coming out of the microphone is positive, and it makes the frequency go lower during the time the voltage out of the microphone is negative. So you're waving the signal in frequency. There is absolutely no change in amplitude if the transmitter is working correctly. However, you take a steady state signal and you operate the frequency dial of your AM radio, and you're watching the signal strength meter as you tune across the signal. At first, when you're way off to one side of the signal, you'll get a little bit of S meter deflection. As you tune closer and closer, right, we'll take a steady state amplitude signal function of the IF amplifier section of the receiver. Your receiver is converting FM into AM when you are slope detecting, when you're tuned off to one side. You're walking up and down the skirt of the selectivity curve of the bandpass filter that's in the IF strip of your receiver. So your receiver is doing the conversion of FM into AM when you're doing slope detection.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
So I wonder if that made some sense, Bernie. Wait for the four beeps, and K2RIW listening.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, I think, you know, it's starting to get a little technical there. It's been a while since, you know, I'm up on this stuff. I should really read about slope detection. I tell you, I had a gun set, 2-meter rig, that I was told when I bought it at a ham fest years ago that it was converted to AM. I guess they were, taking advantage of a young guy, because I was able to hear the FM signals, the AM signals, but when I tried to transmit, everybody told me there was something wrong with my audio. So it took me a couple of years to figure out what was going on. Anyway, I will read up on slope detection, and I just thank you for the explanation, Dick. K2RIW, K2MU.
Yeah, if you Google the word slope detection and radio receiver as a combination with Google, I'm pretty sure you'll find out quite a bit more information. When it comes to kinds of circuits that will convert an FM modulated signal into audio, the usual circuit is called a ratio detector. That's one kind of circuit. And a similar circuit is called a Foster-Seeley discriminator. However, there is a kind of third circuit that in the old days was fairly popular called a Travis discriminator, T-R-A-V-I-S. A Travis discriminator really is a pair of slope detectors combined in a particular way in order to make an FM discriminator receiver. And so the Travis discriminator really is using slope detection, and it's midway between the other two, if you know what I mean. Okay, at this time, we hopefully, because this is a holiday weekend for most people, hopefully the younger people starting to get their license are able to stay up a little bit later. And so, John, I wonder if you've received some emails or other communications this week from the people just starting to get their ham license that have some questions. KC2, WGB, with what we will eventually call Mel's Corner. K2RIW, you got it, John.
KC2WGV. Good evening, Dick. Everybody on the net. Yes, I have two. This one is quite interesting. I have a rotor question from a young ham, John, who is a licensed ham, just started. And he's asking a question about a rotor. Maybe you can explain the whole operation. He understands that he turns a dial and there's a motor that turns and rotates the antenna. But he wants to know, how does the antenna know north from south? How does it know the direction? And how does the needle that tells him whether he's north or south know it? So, interesting question, Dick. Basic, but I'm sure he needs to know. So over to you for the answer, sir.
As they used to say, John, inquiring minds want to know. And when you study the actual motor that's inside of most of our rotators, the HAM-M by Cornell Dubilier, I forget the brand name, but now another company bought them, but the CDR Cornell Dubilier rotator, a very popular rotator, you study what's inside there, you'll see that it has a a squirrel cage rotor. In other words, there's no brushes, there's no windings per se to the rotor. It's just a fixed object, very similar to an AC washing machine motor. That's what the rotor looks like. But the stator windings, there are two windings at right angles to each other. There's one set of windings that makes, the stator windings makes a magnetic field that goes north-south. Another set of windings makes a magnetic field that goes east-west, so to speak. And when you feed voltage into the north-south windings and the east-west windings, the exact same voltage but 90 degrees out of phase. If you start off with the 12 o'clock winding and then feed a 90 degrees delayed signal to the 3 o'clock winding, you are generating magnetically a rotating magnetic field that goes clockwise. And you do that by putting in a 120 microfarad AC electrolytic capacitor in series with one of those windings. The presence, let me drop. The motor itself runs on something like 30 volts going to each of the windings. One winding gets the 30 volts directly. The other winding gets the 30 volts through a 120 microfarad AC electrolytic capacitor. The presence of the capacitor to that second winding creates either a phase lag or a phase lead, depending on how you set up the resonance of that capacitor and that winding. But once you set up the phase lead or lag at approximately 90 degrees, you're making a rotating magnetic field. The rotor wants to follow that rotating magnetic field, and the rotor will flow clockwise. When you move the main dial to the left instead of the right, the wiring inside the control box throws that exact same capacitor in series with the other winding. And now the phase shift goes in the other direction, and that rotating magnetic field goes counterclockwise, and the motor will turn counterclockwise. So this is how you determine whether or not the motor moves from north toward east or from east toward north, by where the electrolytic capacitor is placed from the control head into the wiring that goes up to the motor that's on the top of the tower. Let me drop. In the case of the Cornell Dubilier rotators, that capacitor is supposed to be 120 microfarads AC type, call it a motor start capacitor. And the ones that Cornell Dubilier used to put in there was a waxed capacitor that in a very short period of time would dry out. I remember on a couple of occasions I would go over to Arrow Electronics in Farmingdale and buy a brand new capacitor off the shelf made by Cornell Dubilier for that rotator. And even when it was brand new, because it had been sitting on the shelf for 3 years, it had already dried out. The 120 microfarads was down to about 15 microfarads, and you got a very weak operation out of the motor. Particularly on a cold day, it would refuse to move. So the real solution was to make sure you've got a healthy 120 microfarad capacitor. The right solution was go out and buy a real commercial-grade motor start capacitor rated for the right voltage at 120 microfarads. The ones that were made by Cornell Dubilier were a little bit too cheaply made, dried out too fast, and gave you this problem where the rotor started turning slower and slower and became more and more sluggish, and some days it wouldn't move at all, particularly on a windy day. The motor itself on these Cornell Dubilier rotators have got a tremendous amount of torque capability. You put in a real healthy capacitor, and boy, with your hand, you almost cannot stop the thing when it's mounted in the vise, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So now the motor, you now know how to turn it clockwise and counterclockwise, and there's a gear train in there, so that it's probably got a 1,000-to-1 ratio between the number of turns on the motor versus the number of turns of the mast going down. That you're going beyond 360 degrees or 370 degrees, so to speak. Also coming out of the shaft of the main bell housing of that motor, going to your mast piece of tubing that goes to your antenna, there is a 370-degree potentiometer, wire-wound potentiometer. And the meter itself puts something like 20 volts DC across that potentiometer. The slider now goes between 0 and 20 volts, depending on whether you're not, you're at the clockwise limit or the counterclockwise limit. By the way, that 370-degree potentiometer is wound like a spiral staircase. It's got 1 1/8 turns of the spiral staircase with a wire-wound winding on a phenolic curved sheet of insulating material. That's what you'll see when you turn the thing, when you take the thing apart and look inside. And on the later Cornell Dubilier Ham Am rotators, there's something like a 20 volts DC with a Zener diode making sure the 20 volts stays steady on the potentiometer. As the potentiometer follows the bell housing, as you go from the north stop toward west, toward south, towards east, and back to the north stop again, you're moving that slider on that potentiometer, and the voltage on the center tap of that potentiometer slowly moves from 0 volts to 20 volts, or from 20 volts back down to 0 volts, in my example. So that, that wire, which is the slider of the potentiometer, goes through a series resistor that goes into the Dawson valve movement, the meter movement that's on the control housing bound in the shack, and now the motion of that meter represents some number of milliamps, which is picked up by that slider, the center tap of that potentiometer, going through a resistor going into that meter. And so the meter now tells you where you are, north, south, east, west, if you know what I mean. In the very early days, the Cornell Dubilier didn't have a Zener diode on that potentiometer. So depending on whether or not your 120 volts coming out of Con Ed or LIPA was high or low, the meter would read a little bit clockwise or a little bit counterclockwise of reality. The later versions put in a Zener diode, and that problem primarily disappeared. Over to you, John, KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
M2NBR.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, that was a good explanation. I think that was quite sufficient. The only thing is we have to let him know that the initial setup and aiming of the antenna usually comes in the rotor being set for the north position, and you have a mark on the case telling you which way is north. Most of the ones I've seen have that. So he would have to make sure he has that, mount his antenna, and make sure that's pointing to the north. And I think that would complete his direction problems. If you have anything more to add on that, and then pick up that other station.
Leo, Dick. Rich also recognized. Yeah, there's a whole alignment procedure. What some guys will do is in the shack, make sure that they do some temporary wiring between the control housing and the rotator before they climb the tower with it, make sure it rotates correctly, indicates correctly, and then they will set it at some known position, dead north, dead south, clockwise limit, counterclockwise limit. You know where it is set before you move it. Therefore, you go up on the tower, you screw it down, and you adjust your piece of mast on its U-bolt going to the antenna. You aim the antenna in the right direction. Make sure that the coaxial cable going to the antenna is not going to wind up and be ripped off, so to speak. You add the right amount of slack, and then you go back and check. You then go down to the rotator, aim at some known direction, like the particular repeater, you know where it's located, and make sure you peak the signal in that direction, and then make corrections accordingly. So there's a whole art and science to properly aligning a rotator and make it indicate correctly for you. I heard something like November 2, November Bravo Romeo. If I heard it correctly, Jonathan, go right ahead. N2NBR, question mark, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick. Thank you. Let me let this stop. I'm sorry. I'll pick it up real quick. I have been, good evening, Dick, I'm sorry, K2RIW and the group is N2NBR. I have been for years puzzled by a phenomenon that I experienced back in my earlier 220 days. I had a great Midland, I think it was Midland, transceiver. If I may sort of pull you back to the phase modulation and FM modulation issues. I got a lot of compliments on the air from an audio standpoint on this magnificent rig. I believe it was made by Midland, and I think that the Midland, again, this was many years ago, was frequency modulated, and many of our rigs that we have floating around, we're having to surround ourselves with appliance operations, I suppose, but to make a long story short, and the difference between phase modulation and FM modulation is use in terms of audio quality, and I was wondering if you'd ever experienced that in your travels as K2RIW M2NBR.
Yes, I have, John. If I whistled a continuous 1 kilohertz tone with my mic, with my mouth into a microphone, and I have 2 transmitters side by side, and one of them is FM modulated, and one of them is phase modulated, and then half a mile away, somebody listens to the signal out of transmitter number 1 and transmitter number 2. In that particular example, one is an FM modulated, one is phase modulated, he would not be able to tell the difference. But there's a catch. If now I whistle 3 tones, 100 hertz, 1 kilohertz, and let's say 5 kilohertz, 3 different tones into the microphones, and I do that first into the FM transmitter and then into the phase modulated transmitter, now you would see something very different happening. In the case of the phase modulated transmitter, it would sound like the high frequency tone is much too loud in amplitude, and it would sound like the 100 hertz tone is much too low in amplitude. You get a 6 dB per octave roll-off or roll-up characteristic out of a phase modulated transmitter that you don't get out of a frequency modulated transmitter. The mathematics behind that and why it acts that way is not simple. Just take my word for it, that happens. And if you do a lot more digging with Google searches, you'll get a little bit more information. If you go to the book by Misha Schwartz called Information, Modulation, Transmission, and Noise, that was the textbook that was used in the communication course that I took at my bachelor level in college. Information, Transmission, Modulation, and Noise, McGraw-Hill book, classic, by Misha Schwartz. He will explain it to you, and there's probably a lot more modern books that will explain it. But phase modulation, frequency modulation, they have a relationship, and they have some very big differences. Each has its advantages depending on what you're doing. It turns out that the command service module of the Apollo spacecraft that I listened to while they're on the way to the moon, the audio that they put on there was FM modulated, but the audio was created on a 1 1/4 megacycle subcarrier, and the subcarrier was put on the main carrier at 2 gigahertz by way of phase modulation. So that particular astronaut audio was FM, PM modulation, the combination. And there's a whole bunch of reasons as to why they did that. Just throwing that in just to give you a little bit more complication. It's a fascinating subject, and it's not an easy one to discuss. Let me go over to Rich, back on the rotators. N2EO, granted with your information, Rich. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. I didn't catch the whole thing. I just came upstairs here. You mentioned Cornell Tubalira. I assume John is taking a question for a new ham, so I just wanted to give you an update. I remember the old Cornell Tubalira ham M, sold for $109 in the 60s. Cornell Tubalira rotator division. Cornell Tubalira still makes capacitors, but the rotator division was eventually sold to Hygain antenna company. And Hygain is now a division of MFJ. MFJ bought Hygain a number of years ago. So if he needs parts, he wants to go to Hygain, hook him up in QST. And fixing that rotator is probably well worth the money, Dick, because the rotator that I put up, or I should say that Barry put up for me, the Hygain Ham 4, which is the updated version of the Ham M, is now $649. Let me go reset. And what I was going to suggest, I don't have any personal experience, but I've heard very, very good things about a company called Norms Rotor Service, N-O-R-M-S, like Norman, Norms Rotor Service. I think he's somewhere in Ohio or Michigan. I've heard very good things about him over the years. I've never heard anything bad, but I have no personal dealings with him. So I would check him out he rebuilds from soup to nuts all these rotators, MaxNet and 2EM.
Good information, Rich. And I'm living in the dark ages. Cornell Dubilier used to have the CDR was the abbreviation that was on. In fact, I'm looking at one of these rotators right now. Mine says CDE. Charlie Delta Echo is the brand name on the front cover of the control housing for my so-called Ham-M rotator. And that Ham-M rotator, there must be a zillion of them in service right now. It is a classic. I think there's more of them than there are Kenwood's Icoms and Yaesu rigs around, if you know what I mean. There's a tremendous number of them. And other than a little bit of degree of difficulty of not losing the ball bearings when you take it apart, a guy with a little bit of mechanical engineering capability can definitely service that machine by itself. And a hell of a lot of the times when you think it needs service and you take it apart, it might need it. It might not need it, because the first thing you got to check on is that 120 microfarad capacitor that's in the control head in the ham shack. Is that capacitor in good health? Is it 120 microfarads and not 15 microfarads? Let me drop. So a person who's all thumbs can send it to Norm's Rotor Service, or you can walk it over to Andy, the B2CDL's house, if you're a good friend of him, and he can help you fix it. And so the average ham, at least 80% of them, in my opinion, do their own rotor repair. Their pride is such that they take that apart, re-grease it, make sure that the potentiometer is clean, sometimes replace the potentiometer, maybe replace the screw-down terminals because they get rusty, and so on, and do that kind of a service, or put in a better connector. But maintaining that rotator and buying them on the surplus market, sometimes you can buy them on the surplus market for $30, and they're not in operating condition, and with 1 hour of labor of yours on your part, you've now got a $600 item, so to speak, in good working order. So it's a very good investment. Among the microwave enthusiasts, the Yaesu rotator is now more popular because it's got a lot finer resolution of its meter that indicates what direction. The Yaesu rotator, I think on a good day, you can aim it to the nearest 1 degree. The rotator made by what used to be Cornell Dubilier, then High Gain, and now MFJ, I think is good for about plus or minus 6 degrees of accuracy. If you're using, let me drop. If you're using a 20-meter beam, and the 20-meter beam has got 50 degrees of beam width, and your rotator will rotate you to the nearest 6 degrees of accuracy, as you can tell, you got more than enough accuracy not to worry. However, if you're using that rotator to rotate a 3-foot diameter, a 2-foot diameter parabolic dish on 10 gigahertz, which has a 3-degree beam width, plus or minus 1.5 degrees, then the 6 degrees of accuracy out of the Ham-M would give you a little bit of grief. But the average guy does, and I do it, I make my own calibration chart. The good news is that the potentiometer is nice and clean, although it'll have, in the real world, plus or minus 4 degrees of error. That error is repeatable. Each time you aim it north, you might really be 4 degrees to the right of north, and once you look up your calibration curve, you can correct for that. Another nice thing to know about is because the rotator on its slider, 370 degree staircase potentiometer, because it makes something like 0 to 20 volts, you can take the 0 to 20 volts, set it up correctly into a old-fashioned strip chart recorder, or the modern-day equivalent, a analog-to-digital voltage converter into a computer program. You can now make the rotation of the rotator, move the pen left and right on your XY plotter, or the computer program that gives you an XY plot. The net result now is that you talk some friend of yours into putting the key down on his transmitter for the next 2 minutes. You rotate your antenna 360 degrees while the strip chart recording is going, and on that strip chart will be a beautiful pattern of your antenna. You can now make your own antenna patterns once you're smart enough to do that. assuming you don't have a great big reflective water tower right next door to you, it'll give you a little bit of an ambiguity in that pattern. When the main lobe of the antenna is aimed toward the water tower and you get a reflection from it, you'll get what looks like a side lobe that's not really there. But with some minor, and by the way, you can now do the exact same thing. You choose a friend to the west and you swing the antenna and you make a strip shot recording and you're measuring your antenna pattern. Then you do it with a friend of yours to the north, and you do it with a friend of yours to the east. And pretty soon, by way of the correlation between those three charts that I just described, you'll eventually figure out where the water tower is, and you can take that back out of the data, and now you'll get a beautiful plot of your antenna pattern. Yes, you've now got to take the S-meter reading out of your receiver and calibrate it so that the vertical deflection on the strip shot recording makes some reading, makes some meaning, but that's how I measured antenna patterns as I was developing antennas in my backyard. But you get a kick out of that. I know it's way beyond what John asked us, KC2WGB, but I thought you'd sort of enjoy that. KC2WGB with the next one, K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. Well, I'm sure John in Queens has a lot of information, and thanks for that input, Dick. He does not have a rotor. He's looking to buy a new one. Seems to be bent on buying the high-gain HAM-4, which is the one I have two of. I happen to like them, but I don't recommend products, as you don't, Dick. But great information. And let me let it drop, and I'll go to the second one.
Let me pick up on this one, John. He can spend $600 and buy a brand-new one, or he can go to one of the flea markets and get it for $60. And even if he gets one for $60 that's all scratched and nicked and it's been thrown down a flight of stairs and it looks ugly and it's rusty, he'll be saving himself $500-some-odd to buy a used one, as long as 80% of the parts are still inside. If he wants to, he could save himself a whole lot of money. I'd recommend he at least consider that. Back to you, John. I should have waited for the beep.
Yes, Dick, I recommend that he go onto eBay or something like that, and just do a little research, and he may be able to get one that's in operating condition. I'm sure it'll be a lot cheaper than a new one, and if it's not exactly what he wants, he can send it out to where Richie said and have them take care of it. So I think he has quite a few options, and he wants to do it in the springtime, so he has the time to do the research. I think that's great.
Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, Dick, I know you mentioned that a lot of the VHF, UHF guys like the Yaesu rotator. There's a problem, not so much with the rotator, but Yaesu will, and I got into this discussion with someone selling a digital control box that'll work on almost any rotator. He was telling me Yaesu will not sell replacement gears of parts to their rotator. For whatever reason, they want you to send the Yaesu rotator back to Yaesu. And that's a problem, because a lot of times it can be serviced, like you said, by somebody at home, but it can't get the parts. So it's got to go back to California and then come back. It's a lot of downtime. So I agree with you, Dick. The what's Porno Dubilier, the high gain, is really a good standard. It's a good rotator. They made a lot of updates in it, by the way, since the days of the Ham M. For instance, where the part that you're talking about, the potentiometer, contacts the bell housing to make a ground connection on the wiper. They found, and I had this problem, where it became intermittent. Connection between where the wiper contacts the bell housing would start to hit the metal. High gain, and then later MFJ took care of that problem. They got an extra ground in there. I've taken them apart. I haven't taken the later ones apart coming out of MFJ. But that's one improvement they made. They put a an inline plug, so you don't have to sit there with that two terminals underneath. They made a lot of updates. Also, they've got a delayed braking system now, so when you release the brake delay, it doesn't slam shut and put stress on the tower. there's a delay for the rotator to come to a stop, and then it puts in the wedge brake. All these things can be updated. You get an older HMM and update it to the latest model. Also, Dick, the original HMM had a stamped aluminum gear, which would break in the ring gear. They later went to stainless steel. Back to that, M2EO.
I'm a little bit amazed at my microwave friends, many of whom are using the Yaesu rotator because they like the higher degree of accuracy. And if you can't find parts for it, hopefully it's not often required and the parts don't break. But for a guy who really abuses the thing, I'm kind of curious what part breaks that is not replaceable and has got to be somebody with a garage operation that's going to start producing that part. In other words, if the ring gear is the one that breaks for a person who really abuses it with rotating a 40-foot long boom, great big antenna, and he breaks the ring gear, is that the part that you can't buy as a replacement, Rich? Because the rest of the parts inside, resistors, capacitors, integrated circuits, meters, and whatever, you would think that wouldn't really hang up somebody like you or I. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Well, I know Barry M2MB, I don't know if he's still on frequency. He had a very, very unhappy experience with the AS-L rotor for satellite operations in Yaesu. I think the elevation rotator went bad first, and the azimuth rotator went bad. Yaesu would not sell them parts. My understanding is they will not sell mechanical parts to any of their rotators. I've heard this from other sources. Barry mailed that Azel back to Yaesu. He said they wanted so much to fix it that he just chalked it up as a loss.
I think in that case I would have asked them to mail it back to me and I'd find some other substitute. Did Barry ask them to mail it back to him even though it wasn't repaired?
As I recall, they wanted some time. I talked to Barry, but my recollection is they gave him some crazy price, and he just said, keep it.
Yeah, that is a sad story. But that's the more elaborate version, the satellite version, so to speak, that has azimuth and elevation rotating. It's got two separate rotators at right angles built inside. The main one that people put in the middle of the tower, just for simple azimuth rotation of an antenna, my microwave friends seem to be very happy with it. I haven't heard them complain about needing repair and couldn't get the parts, but it's good to know. By the same token, ICOM, whenever you buy any of the ICOM pieces of equipment and you call up Beaverton, Oregon, I think it is, where their headquarters is located, and you tell them, I've got a model number so-and-so, and I need diode CR13. Can I please buy one of those? And the next thing you know, the thing is in the mail to you, it's already in your hand, and they send you a bill to be paid afterwards. They're very good on parts. Kenwood, by comparison, if you want to buy parts for your Kenwood rig, you have to order them, it has to be delivered to the local dealer, then you've got to go pick it up from the local dealer. It's a great big rigmarole to get parts out of Kenwood, whereas ICOM really makes it easy. And so, a bunch of opinions on that one. Okay, back to you, for the next one, John. Sorry to interrupt you. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
No problem, Dick. The more information we get here, the better. By the way, they're now using digital encoders to resolve even tighter azimuth angles, and they're working on trying to resolve the backlash. Although you don't feel it, the digital encoder shows it. So some friends of mine are working on that, and there are some very expensive rotors that do that. So there's a lot of stuff coming down the pipe. Let me let it drop, and we'll go on to the next one. KC2WGB. All right, next one comes from Tom, who's somewhere in the five boroughs, didn't say. Mel spoke many times about his green wire antenna. This young ham wants to put one in a 70-foot pine tree. His question is, he's going to run it vertically. He doesn't know where to hook up to this vertical wire. Does he cut it in the middle and attach it there at the top or at the bottom? And should he put some kind of cantilevered arm up there to support the downlead. If you can give them a few words on how that should be constructed and what to look out for, and the pitfalls. So back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Mel K2KEY was one of the first guys who really thought out of the box. Whenever you read any of the instruction manuals on how to set up an antenna, a simple dipole antenna, the diagram almost always shows you a pure horizontal dipole parallel to the ground with an insulator in the center. It's a half wavelength long, and the transmission line goes to that center insulator and feeds the left and the right-hand side. That's the way a dipole is normally demonstrated in diagrams. People are led to believe that that's the only way you can set up a dipole. In reality, there's nothing magic about it being horizontal, nothing magic about being straight, nothing magic about being parallel to the ground. You can zigzag it left and right, up and down, droop the ends, make it into an inverted V, make it into a V, an inverted V, sloper, and whatever. However, one of the really good antennas that has had very poor representation up till now is a pure vertical dipole fed either at the center or at the bottom. Let me drop. A pure vertical dipole, half wavelength long, as long as your tree is tall enough to be able to make a half wavelength of wire. And the wire doesn't have to be purely vertical. It could be sloping at whatever angle. In fact, what Mel was really doing with his green wire out of that, I think it was a evergreen-like tree that's in front of his house, as the bottom, I'm going to pick a number, 10 feet of the wire, didn't go straight down. It went sloping off to one side as sort of a J-shaped object. And I think in at least one of the embodiments, he fed it from the bottom. When you take a pure vertical half-wavelength long piece of wire with no center insulator, just one continuous piece of wire, a half-wavelength long, and you feed it from the bottom, from the outer edge, so to speak, that is an extremely high-performance antenna that very few people have ever built. And when somebody does build that, they say, wow, why in the world hasn't somebody told me this sooner? Is what they usually say a week or a month later, if you know what I mean, when they find out what that darn thing can do. The slight disadvantage of feeding it from the outside bottom edge is instead of the antenna having a 50-ohm impedance, it has something like a 1,500-ohm impedance. That's an extremely minor problem. You can feed it in the so-called J-pole-like manner. And if you look up, if you Google the word J-pole antenna, you'll get a lot of information. Or you can put a resonating coil there, and maybe the coil has got eight turns to it, and 1.5 turns from ground is where you put the center conductor of your coax, and the shield goes to ground. So you have a loading coil at the bottom that does an impedance step up between 50 ohms and 1,500 ohms, or you can build a J-pole structure which does that. So it's a very minor additional structure required at the bottom. But once you feed that antenna at the outer edge like that, you could, if you want to, lay down the normal amount of ground plane radials. You don't have to. If you didn't put that ground plane radial down, you just put one simple ground rod into the ground for the counterpoise for that particular antenna. Because you're feeding a 1,500-ohm impedance instead of a 35-ohm impedance, if the antenna was a quarter wavelength long, the feed impedance would be something like 35 ohms. Now you need a very extensive ground plane radial system to get efficiency out of it. But when you're feeding an antenna that's 1,500 ohms, a simple ground rod will do it, and you'll get 90% of the performance you would have gotten if you laid down a zillion ground plane radials. You no longer have to do that. There are guys who have made a VHF, UHF version of the antenna where they use the metal railing of the balcony of their apartment. The metal railing was the whole counterpoise, and it worked like a charm. And the antenna, the radiator, only has to be electronically a half wavelength long. It could be spirally wound. It could have loading coils. It could have top hat capacitors. It could have all kinds of things. So a vertical antenna, half wavelength long, fed at the bottom, very high performance. You could, if you want to, if your tree is tall enough, to start experimenting with 5/8 wave instead of half wave. Get a little bit more gain. But the advantage of a vertically polarized antenna is it has an extremely low angle of radiation. Its center of radiation is quite far above the ground. It tends to clear the local terrain a little bit better. but vertical polarization has a natural characteristic that uses the ground reflection in a more favorable manner, and you get a much lower angle signal out to the horizon. Therefore, you do a much more favorable bounce off the ionosphere. Therefore, you won't go a hell of a lot more long-range DX with that antenna. Very simple, inexpensive antenna once you understand the theory of operation. Maybe that helps a little bit, John. There's probably going to be some more questions on this one. KC2, dub.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
KC2, WGB. K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick. And his next question was, does he have to feed that with ladder line, or can he feed it with RG8? Oh, and another thing would be, can he buy the matching network, or would he have to make that? That was his other question, if he needed one.
That green wire antenna that was in the evergreen tree out in front of his house on Dover Street, he had a couple of different ways of building it. There was a time when he had an insulator in the center of the green wire, and he fed it in the center with a right-angle piece of coax cable that ran down the trunk of the tree. There was another time when he did build the matching network, and he built it and he fed it from the bottom. Now, does anybody make a matching network for a half-wave bottom-fed dipole? I'm a little bit afraid the answer is no. For reasons that are mysterious as all hell to me, that antenna is extremely not popular. Therefore, there might not be a guy out there manufacturing that impedance matching network. I think there's a high probability you might have to build it, but it probably contains $5 worth of hardware, if you know what I mean. It's not a big problem to take a piece of PVC pipe and wind a coil on it and resonate it and tap up on that coil and ground one end of it, and the hot end goes to the dipole. It would be a very inexpensive construction. The greatest amount of effort would be required just to weatherproof it to make sure that the water doesn't get into the capacitor that you might put in there. Let me drop. And whether or not you make that variable capacitor allow you to tune between the low end of the band and the high end of the band as you QSY across your particular band with that antenna. There's nothing magic about it being purely vertical. It can slope off to one side. It can slant in various ways. But feeding it from the bottom, in my opinion, is a really high-performance way of doing it, just that it's got this unconventional 1,500 ohm impedance, approximately. And now, whether or not you run coaxial cable from the shack across the ground out to that bottom impedance matching network, that's probably the best. It doesn't have to be open wire line. The open wire line would be the right way to feed it if you're feeding it in the center. But feeding it in the center mechanically is a lot more difficult. You've got draping wire across the ground. You've got ways of supporting that center insulator and bringing the feed line over to it and worrying about the wind blowing it and breaking the feed line. The nice thing about the pure vertical mounting is that the top insulator, if that swings back and forth in the wind, you don't care about it. The bottom insulator is going to be attached to the ground, so it's not going to be swinging back and forth in the wind, and therefore putting your impedance matching network in a weatherproof housing at the bottom is a rather easy mechanical construction, and then the transmission line can lay flat against the ground or even be buried in the ground if you desire, if you choose the right brand of, let's say, for instance, hardline that's made for direct burial. So it can be a very neat and very high-performance installation. So in that particular case, I would favor hardline feed and not open wire feed. And the various experiments you'd have to do, let me drop. If you're homebrewing that impedance matching network at the bottom, the various experiments you'd have to do is something that would take an hour's worth of your time, if you know what I mean. And talking to your buddies and correcting it a day later, it's not a big investment in money or time. And if you build it in the J-pole-like manner, well, the J-pole would be a correct way to build it for VHF frequencies. I will admit you're less likely to build a J-pole feeding arrangement from the bottom of the antenna if you're doing it on a lower HF band, like 80 or 40 meters. There, your better technique would be by way of a resonating loading coil at the bottom and a tapped installation for the transmission line on that loading coil. If you study the 5/8 wave mag mount that you can buy from many automobiles, you take apart that bottom network. That is the VHF equivalent of exactly what I'm talking about. If you simply took that network on a 5/8 wave 2-meter antenna by taking apart the mag mount and build a beefed up version of it for lower frequencies on 20 meters and 40 meters and so on, you'd be doing exactly the same thing. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Got an answer, Dick, on somebody who's making that antenna.
Go right ahead, Rich. I'm amazed that somebody's building it, because that's a rather unpopular antenna, and it shouldn't be. You got it, Rich.
Dick, it's an end-to-end dipole with a matching network. The company who was manufacturing it was a company called Par Electronics. Papa Alpha Romeo. P-A-R Electronics. I believe they're in Florida, and the thing was so successful and got so popular with the hams, he contracted with the U.S. military. Somebody else took over the amateur version of what Par Electronics was making. I don't know the new company making it for the hams, but if you look up on the internet, Par Electronics, I believe they're in Florida, contact them. I'm sure they'll turn them on to the other company. I know they were making them for 10, 15, 20, I think 40, and I'm not sure if he was making them for 80 or not. And they were, as I recall, they were like somewhere around $60 to $100 a piece.
That's the next question I want to know, approximate price. I think it contains under $10 worth of hardware for a guy that's going to home brew it, but to write a check for $60 or $100 and have the problem go away, that's a possible solution. So it's time we give that pure vertical end-fed half-wave or more dipole a hell of a lot more exposure. It's an extremely high-performance antenna, and a lot of people think that it's not going to do anything different, and they think it's so different from the diagrams they see in the books, they're afraid to try it. Over to you, John, KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Very good, Dick. Sounds great. I think he's going to have a lot of fun with this. I imagine he could take a piece of 1.5 inch or 2-inch PVC, about a foot long, wind about 15 turns on that, connect one end to the green wire, one end to ground, and then just move up in the taps until he gets a good match. That's a good place to start. Like you always say, it's not going to blow up or explode, so he should be fine with that. That's good. One more quick one if you have time, Dick.
Yes, I do. I do recommend that coil be relatively short in the Z-axis. In other words, you would like all of the magnetic field to link all of the turns of the coil. You'll get a little bit higher performance that way. It doesn't have to be that way, but if you took a piece of, let me pick a number, 1.5 inch PVC tubing that is a foot and a half long and wound the wire on it, the coil on it, in a spiral manner, you'd have a great big gap at the bottom between the shield of the coax and the tap point. And that would be creating another reactance and another radiation at that point. It would be awful nice if the feeding structure was more compact by being larger in diameter but shorter in the Z-axis, and therefore less radiation takes place at the base. You would like the majority of the radiation to take place from the green piece of wire, and I think you're going to get a little bit higher performance. But that's just me, and it's my gut feel. Have I done a real good study to find out one's going to work better than the other? Not yet, but someday we will. And I'm back to you for the third one. Go right ahead, John, K2RIW.
Okay, this is another interesting one. Quick. This young man has a G1 handset. You know the old phone handsets, what they look like. And he wants to use that with his rig. And he can see the audio fluctuating with his meter. He knows there's audio coming out of this mic, but it doesn't work on his rig. Could you explain to him the carbon base versus the other type? The little touch on that, and that'll do it. This is my last one. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the old-fashioned television, telephones, the mouthpiece microphone was a carbon microphone. And the telephone circuit, I think, started off at something like 48 volts DC negative, and through a dropping resistor, it applied current across those carbon granules of that microphone. And as you spoke into the microphone, the resistance of the carbon granules went up and down, voltage was developed, and that got transmitted down the line. So it takes a power supply to operate a carbon microphone. A carbon microphone all by itself, you just take the two leads out of the carbon microphone, connect it into a oscilloscope, and shout into the carbon microphone, you will see nothing on the oscilloscope. It's changing in resistance, and that doesn't generate a voltage unless there's a current source into a power supply nearby. There were some later telephone circuits where the microphone element was a dynamic microphone. It was really a miniature loudspeaker. The microphone you're hearing me on right now is one of those. The microphone that's inside of a, this is a Kenwood MC43S, I think it's the thing, which I took apart tonight for the first time in 15 years and cleaned some of the junk out of there so that it would have a little bit better frequency response. I'm noticing a little bit too much sibilance sometimes when I speak directly into it because I had to eliminate one of the pieces of felt in there that was slowly dissolving. I said felt, I meant foam. Let me drop. But a real dynamic microphone is really a miniature loudspeaker. In other words, it's got a magnet, it's got a coil of wire, and a diaphragm. And as you speak into that microphone, and the diaphragm moves, and the coil of wire connected to the diaphragm is moving across that magnetic field and generating real voltage. That's the good news. And the dynamic microphones can be very high in linearity, and they're very high in performance, and very rugged if they're properly constructed. That's the good news. The bad news now is impedance matching. Some dynamic microphones only put out a very small number of millivolts, and they're made for some crazy impedance like 600 ohms. And in some cases, the microphone for your particular transmitter really is a ceramic microphone or an electret microphone, and it's made for some extremely high impedance, like maybe 1,500 ohms. And so the impedance mismatch between the dynamic microphone and the rig could give you too little audio. And in some cases, you could put an audio matching transformer. The audio matching transformer back in the days, I can't remember the name of the company that built these little black cylindrical devices.
Bogan.
Bogan was one of the brand names. What was another brand name?
I know Epic built them, but Bogan and Epic are the only ones I'm familiar with them.
One of these days I'm going to have to go to my parts box where I've got a few of these things. But there was a very popular cylindrical black object about a half inch or 3/8 of an inch in diameter, about a half inch long, with four or five leads coming out of the bottom of it. And that was an impedance-matching microphone, impedance-matching transformer intended for microphone service. And the better ones made could have reasonable frequency response from, say, 80 hertz up to 8 kilohertz. So with an impedance-matching transformer, you can now take the signal coming out of a dynamic microphone, correct it, connect it to the right leads of that transformer, connect it with the right kind of a circuitry, maybe the push-to-talk button and whatever, into the microphone circuit of your transmitter. So in most cases, the dynamic microphone you own and the rig that you own can be made compatible. I didn't say it's easy. It's going to take some study of impedances and voltage value levels and whatever, and proper setting of the frequency response. It's going to, good audio is something worth fighting for, because there's a hell of a lot of guys out there with audio that sounds kind of yucky, particularly the heavily speech-processed audio. Let me drop. The heavily speech-processed audio that's kind of popular on the 20-meter band, it may have punch and reasonable communication intelligibility. That's the good news. However, if you're going to hold a one-hour rag chew with that guy, and you're listening to this heavily speech-clipped, heavily distorted audio, it's not so pleasant. You really like to have relatively flat audio from, let me pick a number, 100 or 200 hertz out to at least 5 kilohertz. If you're having an FM rag chew simplex with a guy, and you have complete audio bandwidth so that it sounds like a good, high-quality telephone, then speaking to that guy for the next hour can be very pleasant. And listening to heavily distorted audio, you don't realize it, but you're using a lot of speech processing interpretation between your ears, and it is tiring to have to do that. I mean, if the guy's audio is so distorted because there's no frequency response beyond 1.5 kilohertz, and it sounds like he's talking through a bale of cotton, if the lows are missing, the highs are missing, or whatever, and now you have to